as the reciprocal relationship between information and entropy. Close brackets. She stared at the six names on the paper napkin, which seemed to stare back at her like reflections in a Venetian mirror. She could cross out Tannenberger right away, but the other five could all have been responsible for the phone call to Valentino, and they were all there that night. Poldi even spotted old Turi at one of the tables on the periphery. He was wearing an ancient suit far too big for him, and single-mindedly devouring one sardine roll after another. Poldi was about to get up and keep him company for a bit, when Valerie nudged her and pointed to the list.
"You don't believe me, do you? You still think I had something to do with Valentino's death?"
"You have to admit it's strange. The last call he received was made from your phone." Poldi made to refill her glass, but Valerie took the bottle from her and tapped the paper napkin.
"You really think one of us is Valentino's murderer?"
Poldi crumpled up the napkin and stuffed it in her handbag.
"Are you having an affair with Russo?"
"What?"
Valerie exclaimed in bewilderment.
"Mon Dieu, what gives you that idea?"
"Well, the way he keeps looking at you. And those kisses this morning, and the cozy way you were sitting together. A hostile relationship looks different somehow."
Valerie stared at Poldi.
"I'm going home. I've got a headache,"
she said, snatching up her handbag.
"Have fun." "Valerie!"
But there was nothing to be done. Valerie left the makeshift banqueting hall without saying goodbye to anyone. Poldi wondered whether to run after her and apologize, but she suddenly felt old and fat, overheated and rather sleepy. How many glasses had she drunk? She hadn't kept count, but it couldn't have been all that many, given the lack of liquid reinforcements. "Bugger it," she muttered to herself. Scanning the nearest tables for a full bottle of wine, she saw that Paternay had at last managed to have a word with Russo. From his gestures, he was pleading his innocence of something. Russo, looking annoyed, said something in reply, whereupon they both left the hall. It went without saying that Poldi had to go after them. She wasn't there just for fun, after all. Somewhat unsteady on her pins, she rose and followed the two men. It was already getting dark when Poldi emerged into the open, somewhat bemused by wine and melancholy. In order to shake off her slight feeling of dizziness, she began by drawing a deep breath. The evening hummed her a serenade of laughter, raised voices and blatting mopeds. Redolent of diesel fumes, tobacco smoke, and the sea, it bathed dilapidated house fronts in the picturesque glow of sodium lights. A fine night, perfect for embarking on a new life or ending an old one. Outside the old bottling plant, enveloped in neon lighting and swarms of mosquitoes, young friends of the bridal pair were fooling around and smoking. A little to one side, discreetly sighted in shadow, stood a platoon of portaloos with a small queue in front of them, and parked immediately behind them were the vans of the catering services. Russo and Paternay were nowhere to be seen. In an unobtrusive and wholly professional manner, Poldi sauntered around the factory and eventually spotted Russo and Paternay in an ill-lit gap between two parked cars. They were gesticulating fiercely, and appeared to be arguing. Cautiously crouching to the extent her knee permitted, my aunt stole closer, right up to an SUV, which concealed her better than the Fiat Cinquecento beside it. Although she could distinctly hear the two men's voices from there, she couldn't understand a word. Russo and Paternay were arguing in Sicilian, and that, it should be pointed out, has as much in common with Italian as Swiss-German with Frisian. The gulf between Italian regional dialects is far greater than in most countries, and Sicilian is more than a dialect. It is a guttural, almost Arabic-sounding mélange, the phonetic heritage of all the races that have ever occupied the island. Significantly enough, Sicilian has no future tense. On the other hand, Sicilians often use the complicated passato remoto in everyday speech. This tense, which elsewhere occurs only in literature and does not exist in German, describes events that lie very far back in time and are consummated and irrevocable. Really, truly, officially, in the past. That's that. It's over and done with. Basta. Sicilians would, for instance, use the passato remoto after their siesta, when referring to the lunch they had earlier in the day. The message is unmistakable. We live in the here and now, and only in the here and now. Be that as it may, Poldy couldn't understand a word. The men's body language, on the other hand, was crystal clear. Rousseau was pissed off with Patanet, who appeared to be furiously justifying himself. Rousseau grabbed Patanet by the collar and snarled at him. All Poldy could hear was, "Avoculti sapaco falaccia," but she guessed it must be a curse or the threat of violence. Sure enough, when Patanet tried to free himself, Rousseau shoved him hard in the chest, then punched him hard in the face. Poldy instinctively ducked down behind the car, so she didn't see if Patanet returned the blow. She merely heard the two men panting, followed by hurried footsteps on the other side of the SUV. Then something flew through the air and landed beside her. Red and white in colour, it lay there unmoving. It didn't shrink, didn't grow, just lay there. Poldy stared at the thing, trying to work out what it could be. Then the solution dawned on her. It was a blood-stained handkerchief. No doubt about it. Poldy obviously couldn't allow such a DNA carrier to slip through her fingers. She fished out one of the little self-sealed plastic bags she'd been carrying around in her handbag since Valentino's death, meaning to secure the handkerchief. Alas, it was too far away, miles away, at the other end of the world. Poldy tried to stand up, but for some reason she could no longer do so. She didn't have the strength. It didn't matter, though. Necessity being the mother of invention, she simply crawled towards the handkerchief on all fours and swam through an ocean of darkness and dizziness until she could at last take hold of the bundle of viscose and bag it. Done. Finished. Relax. Poldy gasped, overcome by nausea, and vomited. Cursing Rousseau's lousy wine, she tried to stand up, really tried, but failed because the world had decided to rotate ever faster. She heard a voice coming from somewhere and saw some shoes just in front of her eyes. Good, well-polished men's black shoes. And they were the last thing she saw. Fade to black. Historico-cultural intermezzo. When Almighty God had created the world and everything in it, he had a tiny little bit of every continent left over. He was satisfied with himself and his work, so he casually kneaded the bits together into a lump and slapped it down on his new world, and bingo, there was Sicily. At that, the angels came hurrying up. "Wow," they whispered, rustling their wings uneasily. "What a beautiful thing you've created, O Lord. An absolute paradise. Only the best bits from all the continents."
"So?" the Almighty said proudly. "It's wonderful."
"Yes," whispered the angels. "But the other parts of the world will be green with envy. There'll be a row, a regular hullabaloo. Not a good start." The Almighty took their point.
"Oh, dear," he said. "What shall I do?"
"You need to even things up a bit," whispered the angels. So he created the Sicilians. Popular Sicilian joke, as told by my Auntie Poldy. Chapter 11 describes a misunderstanding, the after effects of knockout drops, and sundry discoveries. Poldy fails to find her key, expels an uninvited visitor with the aid of a muzzle loader, and makes discovery number one. She gets personal protection and accompanies the aunts to the Lido. There she makes discovery number two, conducts a serious private conversation, and soon afterwards makes discovery number three. Poldie got to her feet with an effort and saw Death standing in front of her. He was looking embarrassed and rather at a loss.
"Well, well," she said calmly. "So it's time, is it?"
Death put on his reading glasses and glanced at the list on his clipboard.
"One moment. Not so fast. You aren't on today's list. Something..."
He cleared his throat nervously.
"Something must have gone wrong."
"You can say that again," Poldie grumbled, smoothing her dress down. "I always thought my end would be more dignified. Look at my dress. Do you know what that cost? Oh, well, never mind, let's make the best of it."
She looked across at the bottling plant. The young people outside the entrance, the wedding guests lining up outside the portaloos, the stray cats, they all seemed frozen in mid-movement. Even the glow from the streetlights looked harsh and ossified.
"Just as a matter of interest, is this eternal damnation, or am I in purgatory?"
"Weren't you listening?" Death snapped.
"I just said something's gone wrong. 'Tisn't your turn yet."
"Meaning what?"
"Meaning you aren't on the list,"
Death repeated more meekly.
"I'm sorry." "Hell's bells and buckets of blood,"
Poldie thundered.
"Bugger the list, I'm dead, and that's that."
"No, Poldie, you aren't."
"So where the hell am I, then? What is this?"
Death gave an embarrassed cough.
Near-death experience?"
Poldie grabbed Death by the scruff of the neck and shook him a little. He was quite lightly built.
"Let go of me,"
Death wailed, brandishing his clipboard.
"Please, I can put you down on the list any time if you're really so keen."
Poldie released him.
"Okay, then, let's do it. Where do I sign?"
But Death lowered his clipboard again, looking positively dejected.
"No, can't be done. Listen, Poldie, it doesn't work like that. Those knockout drops in your wine weren't supposed to kill you, though they nearly did. Is that what you mean?"
Death became all formal again.
"I'm not authorized to disclose information on the subject of destiny."
Poldie got the message.
"So it's a balls-up of the First Order?"
"That's one way of putting it,"
Death conceded. He sounded genuinely apologetic.
"I'm really sorry. Well, I'll be seeing you."
He turned to go.
"Hang on,"
called Poldie. Death was looking rather exhausted, she saw, and no wonder. If you've been on the go since the beginning of time, you're bound to reach burnout sooner or later.
"What is it?"
"When am I for the chop? I mean, just for interest's sake."
"You really want to know?"
"Come on, we've been having such a nice chat."
Death hesitated.
"Very well, Poldie, since it's you," he eventually said with a sigh.
He consulted his clipboard again. Although Poldie couldn't make out any of the names, she saw that they were listed in quite small print and neatly arranged in date order. Death ran his ballpoint down the list name by name and sheet after sheet, and then...
"Ah, there you are. Officially certified, rubber-stamped and signed. Your date of death is the..."
Unfortunately, that was when Poldie woke up. It's hard to say in retrospect who put the knockout drops in my aunt's glass, just as the whole course of the evening remained hidden behind a sort of blackout curtain. Poldie was able to reconstruct only parts of it later on, and we can't tell whether everything happened just the way she thought, whether certain conversations actually took place, whether her recollections are accurate, and whether she really overheard Rousseau and Patinet arguing. The one tangible clue was a blood-stained handkerchief in a zipper bag and her final memory of a pair of men's black shoes. Groaning, cursing, and afflicted with the thickest of thick heads, Poldie recovered consciousness on the ground beside the SUV. She was still a little dizzy. She was thirsty. She had a metallic taste in her mouth, and the veil of oblivion was lifting only slowly. But she was alive. She did feel rather miffed at failing to learn her sell-by date, but there were more important issues to be addressed at present. Like what had actually happened. She could remember nothing at this stage, only those black shoes and the fact that Death had said something about knockout drops, but that sufficed her for the moment. Still groaning, she staggered to her feet like Polyphemus blinded by Odysseus, drew several deep breaths while waiting for the drumbeats in her head to subside a little, and looked around. It was still dark. She could make out the old bottling plant, but it wasn't illuminated any more. Everything was steeped in gloom, no one to be seen. The party was over.
"And nobody missed me, let alone came looking for me," Poldy thought bitterly.
She peered at her watch. Just after 3:30.
How long had she been lying on the ground?
No idea. All she knew was that she could have simply died there for all anyone would have cared. Balls to the lot of them. Still rather wobbly on her legs, Poldy straightened her dress, retrieved her handbag from the ground, and looked up at the night sky. The stars twinkled at her, and the moon seemed to perform a coquettish little hop before it dipped below the horizon.
"Namaste, life,"
Poldy said softly, somehow glad not to have been on tonight's list after all, and set off for home. Cautiously, step by step, stomach churning with rage and assailed by waves of nausea, she tottered home along the esplanade, steadying herself against the walls of the buildings that lined the waterfront. She felt she was in a totally unfamiliar place. She passed no one. No lights were on in the houses, and the dark sea was lethargically slapping the rocky shore. The whole town seemed to be guiltily avoiding her eye. It merely flickered its streetlights in a nervous way and pretended to be asleep.
"If that's your attitude," muttered Poldy, "you can kiss my ass."
On reaching number 29, Via Baronessa, she felt in her handbag for the key and found the self-seal bag containing the blood-stained handkerchief. She stared at the small plastic envelope for a moment, trying to remember where she'd got it from. She failed. And she also failed to find her key, even when she emptied out her handbag on the doorstep. The key was gone. Just then, Poldy heard noises. They were definitely not in her head. Crisp, rhythmical blows. Not loud, but coming from not far away. They were interspersed with scratching and scraping sounds. The noises trickled down on my aunt from above like crumbling plaster, mingled with the sound of shuffling feet and heavy breathing. They were coming from the roof terrace, no doubt about it.
Poldy wondered what to do.
Shout for help till the whole street was awake? Tiptoe away and call the police? No. Because her stomach was still churning with rage, and besides she knew from a reliable source that she wasn't scheduled to die yet, whoever it was that had invaded her house with her key was going to get an earful. Gingerly, she tried the front door. It was locked, but that didn't matter because Poldy, who often forgot her key, had taken the precaution of sticking a spare one to the back of her letterbox. She lifted the little metal box off its mount as quietly as possible, detached the spare key, and silently let herself in. Without turning a light on, Poldy tiptoed into the living room and over to the wall on which hung the antique firearms Montana had eyed so suspiciously. She took down an 18th-century infantry musket dating from the War of the Bavarian Succession, a plain, unadorned muzzle-loader from the Fortschauer Armatur factory, 19mm caliber, with a walnut stock and a long barrel. Its numerous dents and signs of use indicated that the weapon had probably mangled the intestines of several Prussian fusiliers, shattered their limbs, and perforated their skulls. Poldy's father had taken an enthusiastic interest in that particular aspect of Bavarian history, and although Poldy had never really shared his passion, she had kept his small collection of firearms as a memento of him. The guns had long been deactivated, because the barrels were welded up and plugged with steel, but they still had their bayonets. Despite the darkness, and despite her headache and nausea, Poldy managed to fix the bayonet on the barrel. The musket, which now weighed heavy in her hands, seemed to awake from a long dream, and whisper to her about the atrocities it yearned to commit once more. And who could blame it? It whispered. After all, killing was the only thing it had ever been taught to do. But Poldi had no intention of allowing the musket to indulge in any shenanigans. She merely wanted to make a bit of an impression. And so, with the muzzle loader at the ready, and her stomach still churning with rage, she crept, step by step, up the stairs to the roof, whence the staccato noises were coming. By now, she had guessed what was going on up there. Anxious to exploit the surprise effect, she paused on the last step, drew several deep breaths, counted up to three, and then burst out onto the roof.
"Freeze, hands up, or I fire down on your knees and be quick about it!"
All of it in German, of course, to enhance the effect still further. The figure, which had been attacking the cemented gate lion with a cold chisel, uttered a startled cry and spun round. It was dressed in black, together with gloves and a face mask such as bikers wear beneath their helmets. Poldi gripped the musket even tighter and aimed the bayonet at the intruder.
"Don't move! Down on your knees, or I'll run you through!"
Again in German, or rather Bavarian, because excitement had robbed Poldi of her fluency in Italian, and she felt it would be counterproductive, under the circumstances, to stammer. But the intruder didn't move. Rightly so, really, because freeze and down on your knees were rather self-contradictory, and no one threatened with a musket wants to do the wrong thing. For safety's sake, Poldi repeated everything in Italian.
"Down on your knees," I said. "Hands above your head. Move!"
Anyone who has watched TV police procedurals for several decades will have items in their vocabulary suitable for such occasions. However, the man with the chisel still seemed unimpressed.
"Drop that chisel. Take off your mask."
In order to underline her demand, Poldi lunged at the intruder as if about to skewer him with her bayonet.
Ha!
That did the trick at last. The intruder dropped the chisel and raised his hands. But before Poldi could say more, he turned and climbed over the parapet. Or rather, he rolled over the low wall, because he didn't appear to be very athletic.
"Freeze, or I fire!"
Poldi shouted at the top of her voice. But the intruder had already landed with a thud on the terrace of Dottore Branciforti's next-door house and gone sprawling. Poldi heard a smothered cry. Leaning over the wall, she saw the intruder scramble to his feet with a groan, hobble across the terrace, and start to climb down a creeper on the far side.
"I'll fire!" yelled Poldi. "I'll fire on three! One, two, three! Bang! Bang! Bang!"
"Did you really shout bang?" I asked Poldi on my next visit, when she was giving me as detailed a description of the incident as her memory of it allowed. "Of course. Why, what else was I to do? At that moment, the gun and I were, to all intents and purposes, a single entity.
My basest human instincts had been aroused. Higher brain function on standby, nothing but the spinal cord in action, know what I mean? What was it Chekhov said? If a gun appears in the first act, it's got to go off in the fourth at the latest. Make a note of that. It was good advice given to a young writer. Of course, the gun wanted to go off, and it did. Lucky that old musket was deactivated, or I'd have shot the man down in cold blood. That's because something had been triggered. Inside me, I mean. Something atavistic and elemental. In other words..."
"The hunting instinct. I get it."
"Exactly. No need to roll your eyes like that. I was in extremis. I know a thing or two about extreme situations."
I nodded. Always the best policy with Poldi in such circumstances.
"Would you really have pulled the trigger if the gun had been activated?"
An awkward question, I know, but somehow I didn't want to let Poldi get away with her big talk so easily.
"You're trying to trip me up, aren't you? The fact is, the fellow winced when I shouted bang, which proves he thought I was capable of shooting him."
"He got away from you, though."
"Yes, temporarily. Only temporarily. The truth is, I pegged him long ago."
I naturally wanted her to elaborate, but she yawned and said she was going to bed. Whether or not she was also a trifle stung by my scepticism, she deferred the sequel to her nocturnal adventure until the following morning. I spent the whole of the next day working doggedly on my novel. I tried to conceive of it as a kind of weapon, which I had only to become a single entity with for it to fire. But my novel behaved like a musket with a barrel welded up. It wanted, it genuinely wanted to go off, to hit hearts and shred nerves, penetrate skin, flesh and bone. I could sense it. But all that ever emerged in the end was an ineffectual bang. I did, however, include in the first chapter a muzzle loader with which my great-grandfather, Barnaba, beside himself with fury, plans to shoot the white donkey that had kicked him not long before. Barnaba swears that he will stalk the white donkey to the ends of the earth. Still limping, he corners it in the macchia of Ashiriali and takes aim. The donkey fixes him with its trusting, unsuspecting gaze, and then comes the transformation. Barnaba repeatedly hesitates, takes aim once more, hesitates yet again, and hasn't the heart to pull the trigger. In the end, he breaks down and begs the donkey to forgive him. A very emotional and affecting scene between man and beast, with a powerful payoff of the kind I'd learnt at the writer's workshop. Just as a weeping Barnaba is about to hurl the musket into the crater of Etna like Frodo jettisoning the ring, he notices something engraved on the barrel, but all he can decipher is the name of a city. M-U-N-I-C-H. To that extent, my musket had gone off after all. Thanks, Chekhov. By that evening, I suspected I would have to delete the whole load of rubbish the next day, but first, exhausted by my fragile day's work, I flopped down on the sofa in the living room, where Poldy was already sipping a leisurely gin and tonic.
Where did I get to?
To bang.
Oh, yes, that was it.
She seemed to be thinking, or concentrating, like a pianist about to play. I was on the point of giving her a nudge when she started afresh.
By that time, of course, the racket had woken half the town, but the intruder was long gone.
She fell silent again. And then?
Why, then, I called Montana.
Montana, cradling the musket like a vet holding an anaesthetized alligator, ran his thumb experimentally over the blade of the bayonet.
You might have killed him with this, Poldy.
Why sound so accusing? I had to defend myself.
It was already getting light outside. A new day was seeping into the town, sweeping shadows from the streets, sharpening silhouettes and raising new questions. Looking east from the roof terrace, one could already make out the skyline, beyond which the sun would soon arc out of the sea like a golden bubble rising from the depths. Down in the Via Baronessa, voices were fluttering like startled pigeons. My Auntie Poldy guessed that the whole of Torre Archirafi already knew what had happened. Seated in a basketwork chair, she drank one espresso after another as she watched Montana's colleagues from forensics attacking the lion with brushes loaded with colophony. The lion stoically submitted to this treatment, sullenly hugging its coat of arms and defiantly crouching on the terrace wall as if determined never to abandon that position. The intruder had knocked off half its hind paws and half its tail in his attempt to detach it from the wall. How sad, thought Poldy, filled with compassion for the gallant beast. Adhering to the inside of her arm was a plaster where the doctor on call had taken a blood sample. She was utterly exhausted, longing for sleep and oblivion, and for a beer. Montana propped the musket against the parapet and sat down beside her.
Did you really shout bang?
I blurted it out in the heat of battle, so to speak.
She eyed Montana closely to see if he was grinning. He wasn't at all.
And you didn't recognize him?
He was wearing a mask.
What about his movements, his voice?
She shook her head.
He wasn't particularly athletic, that's for sure.
Anyone you suspect?
Well, putting two and two together, he's probably the person who slipped me the knockout drops.
Montana nodded.
What else can you remember?
Nothing. Almost nothing. Black shoes.
Montana held out the bag containing the blood-stained handkerchief, which she had previously given him.
"Whose is this? When and why did you bag it?"
"I told you, Vito, I don't remember. I don't have the faintest idea."
"What's the very last thing you remember?"
Poldi sighed.
"I'd like to get some shut-eye now, Vito. I didn't have a very good night, you know."
"You were extremely lucky, Poldi. If you hadn't been sick, you'd have been out for far longer."
"For good, you mean?"
Montana cleared his throat, and Poldi could see he was genuinely concerned. That pleased her.
"We'll see what the lab says."
"Perhaps it was the same stuff you found in Valentino."
"Not that that would prove anything."
"Oh, Vito."
The forensics team were packing up their equipment. Montana got to his feet.
"Assistente Rissoli will stay with you today, just in case."
"Can't you stay?"
Having briefly checked to see if his colleagues were watching, Montana grasped her hand.
"I'm going to find the bastard. We'll be seeing each other again very soon."
Poldi felt like crying. Not only because of her physical condition, but because it was always the same. Whenever anyone had told her, "see you soon," he or she had really meant, "goodbye forever." To Poldi, that sentence belonged in the shredder, like, "there's a lot to be said for it," or, "I'm really going to leave it at one beer tonight." She had a whole list of such self-deluding headlines. "See you soon" was in fourth place. First place went to the unbeatable, "I really have changed." But she pulled herself together and even managed to smile.
"Go get him, Tiger."
Aunt Teresa, who turned up an hour later, shooed Poldi into bed and joined Assistente Rissoli, a chubby-cheeked young police sergeant, in keeping watch while she slept. Poldi slept all that day and all the following night. The aunts took turns, and Assistente La Rosa relieved Assistente Rissoli, who relieved Assistente La Rosa. Uncle Martino brought reinforcements in the shape of Totti, and Totti lay down outside Poldi's bedroom door and refused to budge. Poldi was unaware of all this. She never knew that Montana had paid a flying visit and dashed off again, or that Valerie had also looked in, dismayed by the night's events and the condition of her lion.
"They'll soon catch him, of course," said Aunt Caterina.
But Valerie brushed this aside.
"There's absolutely no hurry. I'm just worried about Poldi. Do you think she's still in danger as long as the lion is here?"
Good question. The aunts, who naturally feared the worst, decided to have a serious talk with Poldi. But she didn't emerge from her bedroom until the next day, after almost 30 hours' sleep, reasonably refreshed, showered, made up, and looking like a resurrected saint in her white caftan.
"Some scrambled eggs and a big pot of coffee would be just the job."
She got them, followed by the serious talking to.
"You must give up this investigation," Aunt Teresa told her. "It's becoming too dangerous."
Poldi looked at each of her sisters-in-law in turn, then at Uncle Martino, Assistente Rizzoli, and Totti.
"Is that what you all think?"
The aunts nodded. Uncle Martino nodded, and Totti looked concerned. Assistente Rizzoli gestured defensively and abstained.
"Good lad," thought Poldi.
She continued to drink coffee and listen to the sounds spilling into the courtyard from the street.
"The case may soon be solved," she said at length. "That makes it all the more unnecessary for you to go on investigating. Montana will soon catch Valentino's murderer," said Aunt Caterina.
Assistente Rizzoli backed her up.
"Sure thing."
"Has Montana called?"
asked Poldi.
"He looked in briefly and asked after you."
"I see.
So he asked after me. Hasn't he arrested anyone yet?"
"Poldi," Teresa's tone became a mite sharper.
"You're off the case."
"Says who?" The aunts just looked at Poldi. Uncle Martino and Rizzoli kept out of it. Totti continued to look worried.
Poldi had never been the type to welcome interference in her life.
On the contrary, As soon as she scented even the slightest attempt to manipulate her, she turned stubborn. She addressed herself to the dog.
"What do you say, Toti?"
They conducted a brief dialogue without words, then Poldi sighed and sat back in her chair.
"What day is it today?"
"Sunday."
"Sunday again already? My, how time flies. Life simply trickles through one's fingers."
"You're off the case, Poldi,"
Teresa repeated softly. Poldi waved this away.
"Of course. I may be tired of life, but I'm not stupid. If anyone ends my mortal existence before time, it'll be me and no one else."
She drew a deep breath, as if that said it all, relishing the aunt's surprise at her unresisting acquiescence.
"So what shall we do with the rest of Sunday?"
"Let's go to the Lido,"
Aunt Louisa cried eagerly. It should be explained that my Aunt Louisa had scaled the Olympus of Catanian high society some years ago by becoming a member of the exclusive Lido Galatea, a sort of fashionable beach club without a beach, because the entire Lido was concreted out into the sea on volcanic rock and was little more than a big swimming pool with a shack beside it. As a rule, a Lido is a private section of beach where lounges, sun umbrellas, and cabins can be rented. It usually boasts a small restaurant, or at least a snack bar, and, of course, toilets and showers. Usually inexpensive, these amenities certainly make for more comfort than lying on a towel on the sand. In addition to comfort, however, a Lido provides a definite boost to one's bella figura. Most Italians consequently have a favourite Lido on their favourite beach and are as steadfastly loyal to it as they are to their local football club. In this connection, my Auntie Poldi once told me the following joke. 2 shipwrecked Sicilians are rescued after years on a desert island. The captain of the rescue ship is amazed to see that the pair have installed 3 Lidos on their island.
"Why 3?
He asks in bewilderment.
"Well," replies Carmelo, "one for me, one for Massimo, and one we don't patronize."
Any regular patron of a Lido usually rents a changing cabin for the whole season, from Easter to the end of October. No form of membership is necessary, unless the Lido is a particularly smart one with all the trimmings. A Lido designed for certain people who prefer to remain among their own kind, and are happy to pay for the privilege. One that possesses a privacy wall, a supervised car park, and security in general, together with childcare and handsome young lifeguards in briefs and polo shirts adorned with badges, miniature umbrellas in the drinks, and Wi-Fi. A Lido that is turbocharged in respect of bella figura. One like the Lido Galatea, named after the nymph that turned the head of Polyphemus the Cyclops. Appropriate somehow, given that heads are always turning to look at someone in the Lido Galatea, which is noted for its abundance of nymphs accompanied by cyclopses of mature years. By dint of perseverance and a lucky break, Aunt Louisa had acquired membership and shared a cabin there with her friend Ilaria. And the best part of being a member was that one could bring guests. In the best of spirits, Aunt Louisa showed her membership card at the entrance and watched with satisfaction as Poldi, Teresa, and Caterina were each handed a guest card.
"If you'd like a drink, Poldi, a lemonade or a granita, I mean, I'll give you my card and they'll put it on the tab. It's very practical."
"Uh-huh."
Poldi surveyed the establishment with a jaundiced eye. She had no objection to sunning herself a little, paddling in the sea with Prosecco in hand and having a good time, but she harboured a fundamental aversion to any kind of smart set. For Louisa's sake, she refrained from passing any remarks about plutocratic cyclopes and their nymphs, made herself comfortable on a lounger in the sun, and marinated herself in coconut oil. When in Rome, she told herself. But a leopard can't change its spots. The sun's rays gradually restored Poldi's vitality, and the more desperately she strove to recall what had happened before her blackout, the more dangerously her level of melancholy rose like the juice in a battery on charge. From the sun lounger, upon which she was sucking orangeade through a straw, Poldi sneered at all the oiled flesh, tasteless designer bikinis, men in tanga briefs and noisy children staring at their brand new smartphones and texting each other, or experimenting unsupervised with their father's spear guns. Meanwhile, the fathers stood around in groups in the tepid water, pleasurably scratching their hairy chests and pontificating about the stock market, their mother's cooking, or their nymph's physical assets. When Poldi's melancholy level passed the critical threshold, her patience snapped, and she succumbed to a little attack of socialism.
"Just look at these big shots,"
she growled to the aunts, who had no idea what was going on.
"They're criminals, I tell you, all of them. What's more, they think they can buy back their youth with the proceeds of their exploitation, the filthy neocons. They worship the god of profit. They'd unscrupulously sacrifice all the achievements of the Enlightenment to it, plus the rainforests, personal privacy, and the future of Africa. Constitutional democracy and the United Nations, those are the bugbears of oligarchs and mafiosi. All they're interested in is consecrating the global market and bending the entire world to their will. They aim to dominate humanity, and we all play along. We happily dance the rumba of decadence and consumerism."
That said it all. Louisa stared at Poldi in bewilderment.
"Eh? What?
Come on, you know what I mean."
As pleased and appeased as a bull terrier that has just torn its master's favourite sweater to shreds, Poldi was about to cool off in the water a little when she caught sight of Rousseau beneath a sun umbrella. Despite its exclusivity, the Lido Galatea is a pretty big place, and on Sundays, when several hundred people are crowded together there, it is easy to overlook the odd acquaintance. On his own, from the look of it, Rousseau was making phone calls and nodding genially in all directions. The sight of him so infuriated Poldi that the curtain of oblivion lifted a little after all, affording her a brief glimpse of her memory's mise-en-scène. She saw Rousseau and Patanet quarrelling between the parked cars, which proves what a liberating effect misanthropy can have on one's mnemonic capacity. Determined to disinter her buried memories by means of a clarifying interview with Rousseau, Poldi heaved herself off the lounger and headed for him. On the way there, however, she made a further discovery. Rousseau had ended his latest phone call and was nodding to someone on his left. The latter, who was also lying on a lounger, raised his hand and they exchanged a few friendly words. Two men paying each other due respect. Always a pleasant sight, but it knocked Poldi sideways. Because the other man was Montana. Montana with a woman all of 20 years younger. Tanned, athletic figure, black bikini, mane of hair. She looked self-assured and happy, like a 30-something who has already ridden out some of life's storms and emerged with a few cuts and bruises but is still successful, still beautiful. A woman who gets what she wants, who may well be smart, even amusing. In other words, not a welcome sight from Poldi's point of view. Stretched out on a lounger beside Montana, the woman was showing off what she had. Not a great deal, in my aunt's opinion, and laughing heartily whenever he said something. She rested her hand on his upper thigh and gave him periodic little kisses, the kind that dispelled any hope she might simply be his sister or a good friend of long standing. Poldi felt sick. The two turtle doves didn't notice her until she was standing over them.
"Hello, Vito."
Montana stared at her in dismay, but was so startled he remained glued to his lounger.
"Poldi, what are you doing here?"
"I could ask you the same thing, but don't worry, I'm not staying. Would you care to introduce your friend?"
The woman didn't even remove her sunglasses.
"This is Alessia. Alessia Poldi."
"Good afternoon."
Alessia drawled the words so they sounded like a question, and didn't shake hands. The situation seemed to be dawning on her.
"I won't disturb you,"
said Poldy, a marvel of poise and self-control.
Have a nice day.
But before she could go about in a dignified manner and sail off close-hauled, Montana sprang to his feet and caught her by the arm. Let me explain, Poldy.
What for, Vito? You don't owe me any explanation. We're adults, after all.
I've been wanting to talk to you about Alessia for ages.
That would have been most amusing, I'm sure,
Poldy said with an effort.
Over a pleasant dinner for three? Is that what you mean? You'd better let go of me, or I'll make a regular stinker of a scene. Then you'd really have some explaining to do to Alessia, and your nice Sunday would be ruined. On the other hand, it already is, so what the hell?
Montana released her arm and gazed at her earnestly. I'll call you. But give me a little time, okay?
I need a little time.
Another self-deceptive phrase. Number three on Poldy's list. Her one wish was to get away. Go somewhere where she could weep and drink in peace. And preferably, so she thought at that moment, simply drop out of the world and evaporate.
You'd better not call me Vito, she said harshly. If you want to discuss the situation with anyone, simply ask your pal Russo.
Listen, Poldy, I... But no, my aunt wasn't listening any more. She hurried back to Luisa, Caterina, and Teresa, who had been watching the unpleasant encounter at a distance. Poldy had no need to explain much. Aunt Luisa handed over her caftan without a word. Teresa stuffed all their things into the beach bag, and Caterina steered Poldy out of the Lido. It wasn't until they were all in the car that the other three couldn't restrain themselves any longer and asked for details. Poldy wasn't in the mood for talking, however, or even for weeping. She wasn't in the mood for anything except going home.
Tell me something. What's the Italian for disciplinary complaint? Denuncia disciplinare.
Why?
Oh, just asking.
But the aunts weren't stupid.
What are you planning to do, Poldy?
Oh, shed a few tears, pull the covers over my head, and call down curses on the dirty dog. Tomorrow is another day.
The aunts already suspected that Poldy was on the brink of another breakdown, and that Project Joie de Vivre was in the balance. So they impressed on Assistente Risoli, who was waiting in Via Baronessa like a stray cat, that she mustn't be allowed to drink. A mission doomed to fail from the outset, of course, because Poldy had devised a plan on the way home. Scarcely had the reluctant aunts left her alone with Risoli when she sent Montana a rather unfriendly text message, embodying the term denuncia disciplinare. The young policeman's mobile phone rang soon afterwards. He listened, said, and, but, and,
yes, sir,
then hung up, looking puzzled.
I'm afraid I have to go, signora. Commissario Montana's orders.
No problem, Poldy said happily. I can manage.
Risoli hesitated.
Your sisters-in-law said you...
Don't worry about me. I can look after myself. Thanks for everything, and have a nice Sunday.
When she was alone at last, Poldy drove quickly to the Ipersimpli to get in some supplies for the next few days. The party could begin. But it didn't. It simply couldn't achieve liftoff. Just gave a little jerk and then got stuck like an antiquated lift. Poldy climbed to the roof terrace with a stiff gin and tonic, flopped down in the basketwork chair, and raised her glass to the mutilated gate lion.
Here's to you, my friend.
The ice cubes tinkled their serenade of coolness and refreshment. The scent of juniper hummed its promise of farewell and oblivion. The tonic promised tears and bitterness. The sun went down behind Etna. And the sea was as heart-rendingly blue as Poldy planned to be before long. Another shitty day was drawing to a close. High time to round the bend into life's finishing straight, thought my aunt. But human beings are allied to nature by special ties, and free will can sometimes be a capricious companion. Whether it was the light, the beauty of a summer evening, the balmy air, the murmur of the sea, or the sound of Signora Anzalone laughing next door, Poldi couldn't get a drop down. She wanted to. She really wanted to. She was thirsty, she had a plan, and she had plenty of supplies. But she kept raising the glass and putting it down. She watched the ice cubes leave a shimmering trail as they melted. She prepared once more to take at least a sip.
"Drink me, drink me, drink me,"
begged the gin and tonic.
"Bottoms up, bottoms up."
But she still couldn't do it. She tipped the drink into the gutter and tried some straight tonic for once. And it worked. It tasted of disappointment and slaked the worst of her thirst, but as soon as she added even a dash of gin, the strange embargo reimposed itself. She tried whiskey, rum, grappa. Same result. Worse still, although she longed with every fiber of her being to get well and truly drunk, she felt sick if she so much as caught a whiff of alcohol. An entirely new development. Her body was poking fun at her, the lion fixing her with its sullen gaze.
"I get it," Poldi said grumpily. "Your lordship objects. May I ask why?"
The lion said nothing.
"I see. But this won't get us anywhere, my friend."
The lion said nothing.
"Afraid I've got to contradict you. I'm absolutely done with the case. Don't want anything more to do with it. Montana will solve it, or not. Then they'll all raise a glass to success. Vito, his friend Russo, and the lovely Alessia. I couldn't care less, because it's all the same to me. I'm off the case for good."
She paused to give the lion a chance to reply. The lion said nothing.
"Yes," says the know-all who's been hiding up here all the time. "I know I made Valentino a promise, but I can't go on, capisci? I'm through. I'm an old bag with a screw loose, talking to a stone lion even when she's sober."
The lion still said nothing.
"You find that funny, do you? Well, it's all over, that's that. I'm off the case, and tomorrow, my friend, tomorrow, my gin and tonic will taste good once more, you'll see."
On that note, she terminated the conversation and made her way downstairs, intending to go to bed. I don't know if my Auntie Poldi wept that night, or the next. She didn't tell me. Sometimes, though, sorrow simply lies too deep, clinging to one like a difficult child and blocking all the exits. Rien ne va pas. I pictured Poldi listening for ages to Gloria with the volume turned up full.
Chiesa di campagna, Gloria. Acqua nel deserto, Gloria.
I picture her smoking far too much, clattering bottles together, calling down obscene curses on Montana, the Sicilians, and life in general, and eventually falling into an exhausted sleep on the sofa. When she woke the next morning with a headache from too many cigarettes and a surfeit of disappointment, and when she left the house to get some fresh cornetti from the bar Cocuzza, there was a cat lying outside her front door with its throat cut.
Chapter 12
Tells of Cats, a Lion, and a Phoenix.
Poldi writes an epitaph, compiles a new list, and finds an egg.
On receiving a veritable revelation, she knows where to go and is expected there. She mobilizes Aunt Teresa and Uncle Martino and is forced to accept that nobody gets any answers unless they ask questions. She also learns that Sicily boasts many places with odd names and that, with a bit of luck, nice surprises can be found there.
I had a rather embarrassing experience on my most recent visit to Torre Achirafi. I had slept badly and emerged from my lair in the attic earlier than usual, meaning to make myself some coffee in the kitchen and accelerate my progress with Chapter 1. Poldy was already standing at the stove, stark naked except for her wig and waiting for the espresso pot to emit its final hiss. I don't have a problem with naked bodies, aging naked bodies included. Really, I don't. When it's your own aunt, though, you feel strangely self-conscious. I did, anyway, I admit. I stammered an apology and hurriedly retreated up the stairs. "Hey, what's the matter?" Poldy called after me. "Oh, nothing. I can wait till you're dressed." "Am I embarrassing you?" "No, no, everything's fine. I just thought of a phrase. I must get it down on paper." "My, how inhibited you are. Come back, I'll put something on." When I returned, after waiting a minute for safety's sake, she had donned a colourful sarong that barely covered her and was down in the courtyard pouring two cups of coffee. "One question, just for interest's sake," was her greeting. "Are you always such a shrinking violet when it comes to the female form, or is it my age?" "Neither one nor the other," I essayed bravely. "But in your case, I make an exception." "Bravo, Mr. Author. Still half asleep and sharp as a knife already." I joined her at the table and took the coffee she handed me. "Listen, Poldy, it's nothing to do with your age, honestly not. But you're my aunt." I couldn't help feeling a bit inhibited, as I said. "Call it what you like. I'm not going to apologize for feeling embarrassed. In summer, we always used to go around naked in the old days. Not only at home, but beside the Isar, and in the Englisher Garten." "Good for you. My, what a sensitive soul you are. Are there any, you know, passages in your novel? I mean..."
She looked at me expectantly.
"Yes, I know what you mean, and yes, of course there'll be some sex scenes, but all very artistic and tasteful."
She cast her eyes heavenwards.
"Then give them to me to titivate when you get there. They need to be really juicy. Know what I mean? Anyone who pays good money for your novel is entitled to some meat."
I left it at that and drank my coffee. But I did have one question for her. During those few moments in the kitchen, when Poldy had confronted me in such a state of undress, I had caught a glimpse of something on her left breast. Something roughly the size of a beer mat, so not exactly small.
"Tell me, Poldy, what's that tattoo on your bosom?"
"Ah, so you noticed that, did you?" Without ado, she undid the sarong from around her neck and let it fall. "On your own head be it," I told myself, and forced myself to examine her tattoo with the professionalism of an art critic. It must once have been very colourful, but time and regular sunbathing had robbed the colours of nearly all their luminosity. At first sight, it looked to me like a cave drawing that a Stone Age shaman had daubed on the wall of a pitch-dark cave. Black streaks, seemingly applied with raw charcoal, looked as if they had risen to the surface from untold depths. These framed various coloured panes which ran into each other and merged like dabs of watercolour. I made out a species of fantasy bird with a short, parrot-like beak and a long, curly tail. The strange creature seemed to be crowing, and spreading its wings in readiness to flutter into the air at any moment. It looked as if it was straining and stretching, as if loyalty to my aunt were all that was keeping it in its habitual place over her left breast. The longer I studied this tattoo, the more obvious it became that it was the work of a true master, not a botch-up job perpetrated by a kiff-stoned amateur. The thing on Poldy's breast was definitely art.
"Wow,"
was all I said.
"Isn't it just,"
Poldy said proudly.
"That's a phoenix rising from the ashes. I had it done by an anchorite monk at Pattaya in 1975. Everyone went to him. There wasn't much to do in Pattaya in those days. We were the first, so to speak.